This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Who We Are and How We Got Here, Ancient DNA and the New Science of the Human Past by David Reich. This book is read by John Lesko. For Seth and Leah. Introduction. This book is inspired by a visionary, Luca Cavalli-Sforza, the founder of genetic studies of our past. I was trained by one of his students, and so it is that I am part of his school, inspired by his vision of the genome as a prism for understanding the history of our species. The high water mark of Cavalli-Sforza's career came in 1994, when he published The History and Geography of Human Genes, which synthesized what was then known from archaeology, linguistics, history, and genetics to tell a grand story about how the world's peoples got to be the way they are today. The book offered an overview of the deep past, but it was based on what was known at the time, and was therefore handicapped by the paucity of genetic data then available, which were so limited as to be nearly useless compared to the far more extensive information from archaeology and linguistics. The genetic data of the time could sometimes reveal patterns consistent with what was already known, but the information they provided were not rich enough to demonstrate anything truly new. In fact, the few major new claims that Cavalli-Sforza did make have essentially all been proven wrong. 2 decades ago, everyone from Cavalli-Sforza to beginning graduate students such as myself was working in the dark ages of DNA. Cavalli-Sforza made a grand bet in 1960 that would drive his entire career. He bet that it would be possible to reconstruct the great migrations of the past based entirely on the genetic differences among present-day peoples. Through study after study over the subsequent 5 decades, Cavalli-Sforza seemed to be well on the path to making good on his bet. When he started his work, the technology for studying human variation was so poor that the only possibility was to measure proteins in the blood using variations like the A, B, and O blood types that are tested by physicians to match blood donors to recipients. By the 1990s, he and his colleagues had assembled data from more than 100 such variations in diverse populations. Using these data, they were able to reliably cluster individuals by continent, based on how often they matched each other at these variations. For example, Europeans have a high rate of matching to other Europeans, East Asians to East Asians, and Africans to Africans. In the 1990s and 2000s, they brought their work to a new level by moving beyond protein variation and directly examining DNA, our genetic code. They analyzed a total of about 1,000 individuals from around 50 populations spread across the planet, examining variation at more than 300 positions in the genome. When they told their computer, which had no knowledge of the population labels, to cluster the individuals into 5 groups, the results corresponded uncannily well to commonly held intuitions about the deep ancestral divisions among humans: West Eurasians, East Asians, Native Americans, New Guineans, and Africans. Cavalli-Sforza was especially interested in interpreting the genetic clusters among present-day people in terms of population history. He and his colleagues analyzed their blood group data by using a technique that identifies combinations of biological variations that are most efficient at summarizing differences across individuals. Plotting these combinations of blood group types onto a map of West Eurasia, they found that the one summarizing the most variation across individuals reached its extreme value in the Near East and declined along a southeast to northwest gradient into Europe. They interpreted this as a genetic footprint of the migration of farmers into Europe from the Near East, known from archaeology to have occurred after 9,000 years ago. The declining intensity suggested to them that after arriving in Europe, the first farmers mixed with local hunter-gatherers, accumulating more hunter-gatherer ancestry as they expanded, a process they called demic diffusion. Until recently, many archaeologists viewed the demic diffusion model as an exemplary merging of insights from archaeology and genetics. The model that Cavalli-Sforza and colleagues proposed to describe the data was intellectually attractive, but it was wrong. Its flaws became apparent beginning in 2008, when Gian Novembre and colleagues demonstrated that gradients like those observed in Europe can arise without migration. They then showed that a Near Eastern farming expansion into Europe might counterintuitively cause the mathematical technique that Cavalli-Sforza used to produce a gradient perpendicular to the direction of migration, not parallel to it, as had been seen in the real data. It took the revolution wrought by the ability to extract DNA from ancient bones, the ancient DNA revolution, to drive a nail into the coffin of the demic diffusion model. The ancient DNA revolution documented that the first farmers, even in the most remote reaches of Europe, Britain, Scandinavia, and Iberia, had very little hunter-gatherer-related ancestry. In fact, they had less hunter-gatherer ancestry than is present in diverse European populations today. The highest proportion of early farmer ancestry in Europe is today not in Southeast Europe, the place where Cavalli-Sforza thought it was most common based on the blood group data, but instead is in the Mediterranean island of Sardinia to the west of Italy. The example of Cavalli-Sforza's maps shows why his Sforza's grand bet went sour. He was correct in his assumption that the present-day genetic structure of populations echoes some of the great events in the human past. For example, the lower genetic diversity of non-Africans compared to Africans reflects the reduced diversity of the modern human population that expanded out of Africa and the Near East after around 50,000 years ago. But the present-day structure of human populations cannot recover the fine details of ancient events. The problem is not just that people have mixed with their neighbors, blurring the genetic signatures of past events. It is actually far more difficult, in that we now know from ancient DNA that the people who live in a particular place today almost never exclusively descend from the people who lived in the same place far in the past. Under these circumstances, the power of any study that attempts to reconstruct past population movements from present-day populations is limited. In the History and Geography of Human Genes, Cavalli-Sforza wrote that he was excluding from his analysis populations known to be the product of major migrations, such as those of European and African ancestry in the Americas that owe their origin to transatlantic migrations in the last 500 years, or European minorities such as Roma and Jews. His bet was that the past was a much simpler place than the present, and that by focusing on populations today that are not affected by major migrations in their recorded history, he might be studying direct descendants of people who lived in the same places long before. But what the study of ancient DNA has now shown is that the past was no less complicated than the present. Human populations have repeatedly turned over. Cavalli-Sforza's transformative contribution to the field of genetic studies of human prehistory recalls the story of Moses, a visionary leader whose achievement was greater than that of anyone who followed him, and who created a new template for seeing the world. The Bible says, "No prophet ever arose again in Israel like Moses," but also tells how Moses was not allowed to reach the Promised Land. After leading his people for 40 years through the wilderness, Moses climbed the mountain of Nebo and looked west over the Jordan River to see the land his people had been promised. But he was not allowed to enter that land. That privilege had been reserved for his successors. So it is with genetic studies of the past. Cavalli-Sforza saw before anyone else the full potential of genetics for revealing the human past. But his vision predated the technology needed to fulfill it. Today, however, things are very different. We have several hundred thousand times more data, and in addition we have access to the rich load of information contained in ancient DNA, which has become a more definitive source of information about past population movements than the traditional tools of archaeology and linguistics. The first five ancient human genomes were published in 2010. A few archaic Neanderthal genomes, the archaic Denisova genome, and an approximately 4,000-year-old individual from Greenland. The next few years saw the publication of genome-wide data from five additional humans, followed by a burst of data from 38 individuals in 2014. But in 2015, whole genome analysis of ancient DNA went into hyperdrive. Three papers added genome-wide datasets from another 66, then 100, and then 83 samples. By August 2017, my laboratory alone had generated genome-wide data for more than 3,000 ancient samples. We are now producing data so fast that the time lag between data production and publication is longer than the time it takes to double the data in the field. Much of the technology for the genome-wide ancient DNA revolution was invented by Svante Paabo and his colleagues at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, who developed it to study extremely old samples such as archaic Neanderthals and Denisovans. My contribution has been to scale up the methods to study large numbers of relatively more recent samples, albeit still many thousands of years old. The traditional length of an apprenticeship is 7 years, and I began mine in 2007, when I started working with Paabo on the Neanderthal and Denisova genome projects. In 2013, Paabo helped me to establish my own ancient DNA laboratory, the first in the United States focused on studying whole genome ancient human DNA. My partner in this effort has been Nadine Rowland, who did her own 7-year apprenticeship in Paabo's laboratory before she came to mine. Our idea was to make ancient DNA industrial, to build an American-style genomics factory out of the techniques developed in Europe to study individual samples. Rowland and I realized that a technique developed by Matthias Meyer and Xiaomei Fu in Paabo's laboratory could be the key to the industrial-scale study of ancient DNA. Meyer and Fu's invention was born of necessity. The need to extract DNA from an approximately 40,000-year-old early modern human from Yan Yuan Cave in China. When Meyer and Fu extracted DNA from Yan Yuan's leg bones, they found that only about 0.02% of it was from the man himself. The rest came from microbes that had colonized his bones after he died. This made direct sequencing too expensive, even using the 100,000 times cheaper technology that had become available after around 2006. To get around this challenge, Meyer and Fu borrowed a page from the playbook of methods developed by medical geneticists. Just as medical geneticists had developed methods to isolate DNA from the 2% of the genome that is most interesting, and to discard the other 98%, Meyer and Fu isolated a tiny fraction of sequences from the Yuan Yuan bone that were human, and discarded the rest. The method of DNA isolation that Meyer and Fu developed has been central to the success of the ancient DNA revolution. In the 1990s, molecular biologists learned how to adapt laser etching techniques, invented for printing electronic circuits, to attach millions of DNA sequences of their choice to silicon or glass wafers. These sequences could then be cut off the wafers using molecular scissors, enzymes, and released into a watery mix. Meyer and Fu took advantage of this method to synthesize 52-letter-long sequences of DNA that, overlapping like shingles on a roof, covered much of human chromosome 21. Exploiting DNA's tendency to bind to highly similar sequences, they fished out the DNA sequences from Yan Yuan that they were interested in by using as bait the sequences they had artificially synthesized. They found that a large fraction of the DNA they obtained was from Yan Yuan's genome. Not only that, but it was from the parts of Yan Yuan's genome that they wanted to study. They analyzed the data to show that Yan Yuan was an early modern human, part of the lineage leading to present-day East Asians. He did not have a particularly large amount of ancestry from archaic human lineages that were diverged by hundreds of thousands of years from modern human lineages, contradicting earlier claims based on the shape of his skeleton. Roland and I adapted this technique to study the whole genome. We worked with our colleagues in Germany to synthesize 52-letter-long DNA sequences covering more than a million positions at which people are known to vary. We use these BATE sequences to enrich for human compared to microbial DNA, which in some cases increased the fraction of DNA that was of interest to us by more than 100-fold. We gained another approximately 10-fold jump in efficiency because we only targeted informative positions in the genome. We automated the whole approach, processing the DNA using robots that allowed a single person to study more than 90 samples at once in the span of a few days. We hired a team of technicians to grind powder out of ancient remains, to extract DNA from the powder, and then to turn the extracted DNA into a form that we could sequence. The laboratory work was only the beginning. An equally intricate task was sorting the billions of DNA sequences into the individuals to whom they belonged, analyzing the data, and weeding out samples with evidence of contamination, and creating an easily accessible data set. Shop Malik, a physicist who had joined my laboratory 6 years before, set up our computers to do all of this, and continually updated our strategy for processing the data as the nature of the data evolved and its volume increased. The results were even better than we had hoped. The cost of producing genome-wide data dropped to less than $500 per sample. This was many dozens of times cheaper than brute force whole genome sequencing. Even better, our method made it possible to get genome-wide data out of around half of the skeletal samples we screened, although the success rate, of course, varied depending on the degree to which the skeletons we examined had been preserved. For example, we have obtained about 75% success rates for ancient samples from the cold climate of Russia, but only around 30% for samples from the hot Near East. These advances mean that whole genome study of ancient DNA no longer requires screening large numbers of skeletal remains before it is possible to find a few individuals whose DNA can be analyzed. Instead, a substantial fraction of screen samples dating to the last 10,000 years can now be converted to working genome-wide data. The new methods have made it possible to analyze thousands of samples in a single study. With such data, it is possible to reconstruct population changes in exquisite detail, transforming our understanding of the past. By the end of 2015, my ancient DNA laboratory at Harvard had published more than half of the world's genome-wide human ancient DNA. We discovered that the population of Northern Europe was largely replaced by a mass migration from the Eastern European steppe after 5,000 years ago. That farming developed in the Near East more than 10,000 years ago among multiple highly differentiated human populations that then expanded in all directions and mixed with each other along with the spread of agriculture, and that the first human migrants into the remote Pacific Islands, beginning around 3,000 years ago, were not the sole ancestors of the present-day inhabitants. In parallel, I initiated a project to survey the diversity of the world's present-day populations, using a microchip for analyzing human variation that my collaborators and I designed specifically for the purpose of studying the human past. We used the chip to study more than 10,000 individuals from more than 1,000 populations worldwide, a dataset that has become a mainstay of studies of human variation, not just in my laboratory, but also in other laboratories around the world. The resolution with which this revolution has allowed us to reconstruct events in the human past is stunning. I remember a dinner at the end of graduate school with my PhD supervisor, David Goldstein, and his wife, Kavita Nair, both of whom had been students of Kabali Tsortza. It was 1999, a decade before the advent of genome-wide ancient DNA, and we daydreamed together, wondering how accurately events of the past could be reconstructed by traces left behind. After a grenade explosion in a room, could the exact position of each object prior to the explosion be reconstructed by piecing together the scattered remains and studying the shrapnel in the wall? Could languages long extinct be recalled by unsealing a cave still reverberating with the echoes of words spoken there thousands of years ago? Today, ancient DNA is enabling this kind of detailed reconstruction of deep relationships among ancient human populations. These days, human genome variation has surpassed the traditional toolkit of archaeology, the study of the artifacts left behind by past societies, and what it can reveal of changes in human populations in the deep past. This has come as a surprise to nearly everyone. Carl Zimmer, a science journalist at the New York Times who has written frequently about this new field, told me that when he was assigned by his newspaper to cover the study of ancient DNA, he agreed to do it as a service to the science team, thinking it would be a minor sideshow to his main focus on evolution and human physiology. He imagined writing an article about the field every 6 months or so, and that the rush of discoveries would end after a year or two. Instead, Zimmer now finds himself dealing with a major new scientific paper every few weeks, even as developments are accelerating and the revolution intensifies. This book is about the genome revolution in the study of the human past. This revolution consists of the avalanche of discoveries based on data taken from the whole genome, meaning the entire genome analyzed at once, instead of just small stretches of it such as mitochondrial DNA. The revolution has been made far more powerful by the new technologies for extracting whole genomes worth of DNA from ancient humans. I make no attempt to trace the history of the field of genetic studies of the past, the decades of scientific analysis of human variation that began with studies of skeletal variation and continued with studies of genetic variation in tiny snippets of the human genome. These efforts provided insights into population relationships and migrations, but those insights pale when compared to the dazzling information provided by the extraordinary tranches of data that began to be available after 2009. Before and after that year, studies of one or a few locations in the genome were occasionally the basis for important discoveries, providing evidence in favor of some scenarios over others. Yet, genetic evidence before around 2009 was mostly incidental to studies of the human past in other fields, a poor handmaiden to the main business of archaeology. Since 2009, though, whole genome data have begun to challenge long-held views in archaeology, history, anthropology, and even linguistics, and to resolve controversies in those fields. The ancient DNA revolution is rapidly disrupting our assumptions about the past. Yet, there is at present no book by a working geneticist that lays out the impact of the new science and explains how it can be used to establish compelling new facts. The findings needed to grasp the scope of the ancient DNA revolution are scattered among hard-to-read, jargon-filled scientific papers, sometimes supplemented by hundreds of pages of dense notes on methodology. In Who We Are and How We Got Here, I aim to offer readers a clear view through this extraordinary window into the past, to provide a book about the ancient DNA revolution intended for lay reader and specialist alike. My goal is not to present a synthesis. The field is moving too quickly. By the time this book reaches readers, some advances that it describes will have been superseded or even contradicted. In the 3 years since I began writing, many fresh findings have emerged, so that most of what I describe here is based on results obtained after I started. I hope that readers will take the topics I discuss as examples of the disruptive power of whole genome studies, not as a definitive summary of the state of the science. My approach is to take readers through the process of discovery, with each chapter serving as an argument that has as its goal to bring readers, who may have come with one perspective when they started, to another place when they finish. I try to make a virtue of my laboratory's central role in the ancient DNA revolution, by telling a story of my own work where it is relevant, as this is a subject on which I can speak with great authority, while also discussing work in which I was not involved when it is critical to the story. Because I take this approach, the book disproportionately highlights the work from my laboratory. I apologize that I have been able to mention by name only a tiny fraction of the people who made equally important contributions. My priority has been to convey the excitement and surprise of the genome revolution, and to take readers on a compelling narrative path through it, not to write a scientific review. I also highlight some of the great themes that are emerging, especially the finding that mixture between highly differentiated populations is a recurrent process in the human past. Today, many people assume that humans can be grouped biologically into primeval groups, corresponding to our notion of races, whose origins are populations that separated tens of thousands of years ago. But this long-held view about race has just in the last few years been proven wrong, and the critique of concepts of race that the new data provide is very different from the classic one that has been developed by anthropologists over the last 100 years. A great surprise that emerges from the genome revolution is that in the relatively recent past, human populations were just as different from each other as they are today, but that the fault lines across populations were almost unrecognizably different from today. DNA extracted from remains of people who lived, say, 10,000 years ago, shows that the structure of human populations at that time was qualitatively different. Present-day populations are blends of past populations, which were blends themselves. The African-American and Latino populations of the Americas are only the latest in a long line of major population mixtures. Who we are and how we got here is divided into three parts. Part one, the deep history of our species, describes how the human genome not only provides all the information that a fertilized human egg needs to develop, but also contains within it the history of our species. Chapter 1, How the Genome Explains Who We Are, argues that the genome revolution has taught us about who we are as humans, not by revealing the distinctive features of our biology compared to other animals, but by uncovering the history of migrations and population mixtures that formed us. Chapter 2, Encounters with Neanderthals, reveals how the breakthrough technology of ancient DNA provided data from Neanderthals, our big-brained cousins, and showed how they interbred with the ancestors of all modern humans living outside of Africa. The chapter also explains how genetic data can be used to prove that ancient mixture between populations occurred. Chapter 3, Ancient DNA Opens the Floodgates, highlights how ancient DNA can reveal features of the past that no one had anticipated, starting with the discovery of the Denisovans, a previously unknown archaic population that had not been predicted by archaeologists, and that mixed with the ancestors of present-day New Guineans. The sequencing of the Denisovan genome unleashed a cavalcade of discoveries of additional archaic populations and mixtures, and demonstrated unequivocally that population mixture is central to human nature. Part 2, How We Got to Where We Are Today, is about how the genome revolution and ancient DNA have transformed our understanding of our own particular lineage of modern humans. And it takes readers on a tour around the world with population mixture as a unifying theme. Chapter 4, Humanity's Ghosts, introduces the idea that we can reconstruct populations that no longer exist in unmixed form, based on the bits of genetic material they have left behind in present-day people. Chapter 5, The Making of Modern Europe, explains how Europeans today descend from three highly divergent populations, which came together over the last 9,000 years in a way that archaeologists never anticipated, before ancient DNA became available. Chapter 6, The Collision That Formed India, explains how the formation of South Asian populations parallels that of Europeans. In both cases, a mass migration of farmers from the Near East after 9,000 years ago mixed with previously established hunter-gatherers, and then a second mass migration from the Eurasian steppe after 5,000 years ago brought a different kind of ancestry, and probably Indo-European languages as well. Chapter 7, In Search of Native American Ancestors, shows how the analysis of modern and ancient DNA has demonstrated that Native American populations, prior to the arrival of Europeans, derive ancestry from multiple major pulses of migration from Asia. Chapter 8, The Genomic Origins of East Asians, describes how much of East Asian ancestry derives from major expansions of populations from the Chinese agricultural heartland. Chapter 9, Rejoining Africa to the Human Story, highlights how ancient DNA studies are beginning to peel back the veil on the deep history of the African continent, drawn by the great expansions of farmers in the last few thousand years that overran or mixed with previously resident populations. Part 3, The Disruptive Genome, focuses on the implications of the genome revolution for society. It offers some suggestions for how to conceive of our personal place in the world, our connection to the more than 7 billion people who live on Earth with us, and the even larger numbers of people who inhabit our past and future. Chapter 10, The Genomics of Inequality, shows how ancient DNA studies have revealed the deep history of inequality in social power among populations, between the sexes, and among individuals within a population, based on how that inequality determines success or failure of reproduction. Chapter 11, The Genomics of Race and Identity, argues that the orthodoxy that has emerged over the last century, the idea that human populations are all too closely related to each other for there to be substantial average biological differences among them, is no longer sustainable, while also showing that racist pictures of the world that have long been offered as alternatives are even more in conflict with the lessons of the genetic data. The chapter suggests a new way of conceiving the differences among human populations, a way informed by the genome revolution. Chapter 12, The Future of Ancient DNA, is a discussion of what comes next in the genome revolution. It argues that the genome revolution, with the help of ancient DNA, has realized Luca Cavalli-Sforza's dream, emerging as a tool for investigating past populations that is no less useful than the traditional tools of archaeology and historical linguistics. Ancient DNA and the genome revolution can now answer a previously unresolvable question about the deep past, the question of what happened, how ancient peoples related to each other, and how migrations contributed to the changes evident in the archaeological record. Ancient DNA should be liberating to archaeologists, because with answers to these questions in reach, archaeologists can get on with investigating what they have always been at least as interested in, which is why the changes occurred. Before diving into the book, I will recount something that happened during a guest lecture I gave at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 2009. Mine was one of the last lectures of the term, meant to add spice to a course aimed at introducing students to computer-aided research into genomes with the goal of finding cures for disease. As I addressed Indian population history, an undergraduate sitting at the center of the front row stared me down. When I concluded, she asked me with a grin, "How do you get funded to do this stuff?" I mumbled something about how the human past shaped genetic variation, and about how, in order to identify risk factors for disease, it is important to understand that past. I gave the example of how among the thousands of distinctive human populations of India, there are high rates of disease because mutations that happened to be carried by the founders increased in frequency as the groups expanded. I make arguments along these lines in my applications to the U.S. National Institutes of Health, in which I propose to find disease risk factors that occur at different frequencies across populations. Grants of this type have funded much of my work since I started my laboratory in 2003. True as these arguments are, I wish I had responded differently. We scientists are conditioned by the system of research funding to justify what we do in terms of practical application to health or technology. But shouldn't intrinsic curiosity be valued for itself? Shouldn't fundamental inquiry into who we are be the pinnacle of what we as a species hope to achieve? Isn't an attribute of an enlightened society that it values intellectual activity that may not have immediate economic or other practical impact? The study of the human past, as of art, music, literature, or cosmology, is vital because it makes us aware of aspects of our common condition that are profoundly important and that we heretofore never imagined.
Part 1. The Deep History of Our Species. 1. How the genome explains who we are. The Master Chronicle of Human Variation. To understand why genetics is able to shed light on the human past, it is necessary to understand how the genome, defined as the full set of genetic code each of us inherits from our parents, records information. Francis Crick, Rosalind Franklin, James Watson, and Maurice Wilkins showed in 1953 that the genome is written out in twin chains of about 3 billion chemical building blocks, 6 billion in all, that can be thought of as the letters of an alphabet. A, adenine, C, cytosine, G, guanine, and T, thymine. What we call a gene consists of tiny fragments of these chains, typically around 1,000 letters long, which are used as templates to assemble the proteins that do most of the work in cells. In between the genes is non-coding DNA, sometimes referred to as junk DNA. The order of the letters can be read by machines that perform chemical reactions on fragments of DNA, releasing flashes of light as the reactions pass along the length of the DNA sequence. The reactions emit a different color for each of the letters, A, C, G, and T, so that the sequence of letters can be scanned into a computer by a camera. Although the great majority of scientists are focused on the biological information that is contained within the genes, there are also occasional differences between DNA sequences. These differences are due to random errors in copying of genomes, known as mutations, that occurred at some point in the past. It is these differences, occurring about 1 every 1,000 letters or so in both genes and in junk, that geneticists study to learn about the past. Over the approximately 3 billion letters, there are typically around 3 million differences between unrelated genomes. The higher the density of differences separating two genomes on any segment, the longer it has been since the segments shared a common ancestor, as the mutations accumulate at a more or less constant rate over time. So the density of differences provides a biological stopwatch, a record of how long it has been since key events occurred in the past. The first startling application of genetics to the study of the past involved mitochondrial DNA. This is a tiny portion of the genome, only approximately 1/200,000th of it, which is passed down along the maternal line from mother to daughter to granddaughter. In 1987, Alan Wilson and his colleague sequenced a few hundred letters of mitochondrial DNA from diverse people around the world. By comparing the mutations that were different among these sequences, he and his colleagues were able to reconstruct a family tree of maternal relationships. What they found is that the deepest branch of the tree, the branch that left the main trunk earliest, is found today only in people of sub-Saharan African ancestry, suggesting that the ancestors of modern humans lived in Africa. In contrast, all non-Africans today descend from a later branch of the tree. This finding became an important part of the triumphant synthesis of archaeological and genetic and skeletal evidence that emerged in the 1980s and 1990s for the theory that modern humans descend from ancestors who lived in the last 100,000 years or so in Africa. Based on the rate at which mutations are known to accumulate, Wilson and his colleagues estimated that the most recent African ancestor of all the branches, mitochondrial Eve, lived sometime after 200,000 years ago. The best current estimate is around 160,000 years ago, although it is important to realize that, like most genetic dates, this one is imprecise because of uncertainty about the true rate at which human mutations occur. The finding of such a recent common ancestor was exciting because it refuted the multi-regional hypothesis.
according to which present-day humans living in many parts of Africa and Eurasia descend substantially from an early dispersal, at least 1.8 million years ago, of Homo erectus, a species that made crude stone tools and had a brain about two-thirds the size of ours. The multi-regional hypothesis implied that descendants of Homo erectus evolved in parallel across Africa and Eurasia to give rise to the populations that live in the same places today. The multi-regional hypothesis would therefore predict that there would be mitochondrial DNA sequences among present-day people that are separated by close to 2 million years, the age of the dispersal of Homo erectus. However, the genetic data was impossible to reconcile with this prediction. The fact that all people today share a common mitochondrial DNA ancestor about 10 times more recently showed that humans today largely descend from a much later expansion from Africa. Anthropological evidence pointed to a likely scenario for what occurred. The earliest human skeletons with anatomically modern features, defined as falling within the range of variation of all humans today, with regard to having a globular brain case and other traits, date up to 200 to 300,000 years ago, and are all from Africa. Outside of Africa and the Near East, though, there is no convincing evidence of anatomically modern humans older than 100,000 years, and very limited evidence older than around 50,000 years. Archaeological evidence of stone tool types also points to a great change after around 50,000 years ago, a period known to archaeologists of West Eurasia as the Upper Paleolithic, and to archaeologists of Africa as the Later Stone Age. After this time, the technology for manufacturing stone tools became very different, and there were changes in style every few thousand years, compared to the glacial, earlier pace of change. Humans in this period also began to leave behind far more artifacts that revealed their aesthetic and spiritual lives. Beads made of ostrich eggshells, polished stone bracelets, body paint made from red iron oxide, and the world's first representational art. The world's earliest known figurine is roughly 40,000-year-old Lion Man, carved from a woolly mammoth tusk, found in Hohenstein-Stadel in Germany. The approximately 30,000-year-old drawings of pre-Ice Age beasts, found on the walls of Chauvet Cave in France, even today are recognizable as transcendent art. The dramatic acceleration of change in the archaeological record after around 50,000 years ago was also reflected by evidence of population change. The Neanderthals, who had evolved in Europe by around 400,000 years ago, and are considered archaic in the sense that their skeletal shape did not fall within present-day human variation, went extinct in their last holdout of Western Europe between about 41,000 and 39,000 years ago, within a few thousand years of the arrival of modern humans. Population turnovers also occurred elsewhere in Eurasia, as well as in southern Africa, where there is evidence of abandonment of sites and the sudden appearance of later Stone Age cultures. The natural explanation for all these changes was the spread of an anatomically modern human population, whose ancestors included mitochondrial Eve, who practiced a sophisticated new culture, and who largely replaced the people who lived in each place before. The siren call of the genetic switch. The finding that genetics could help to distinguish between competing hypotheses of human origins led in the 1980s and 1990s to exuberance about the power of the discipline to provide simple explanations. Some even wondered if genetics might be able to do more than provide a supporting line of evidence for the spread of modern humans from Africa and the Near East after around 50,000 years ago. Perhaps genes could also be the cause of that spread, offering an explanation as simple and beautiful as the four-letter code written in DNA for the quickening pace of change in the archaeological record. the anthropologist best known for embracing the idea that a genetic change might explain how we came to be behaviorally distinct from our predecessors, was Richard Klein. He put forward the idea that the later Stone Age revolution of Africa and the upper Paleolithic revolution of Western Eurasia, when recognizably modern human behavior burst into full flower after about 50,000 years ago, were driven by the rise in frequency of a single mutation of a gene affecting the biology of the brain, which permitted the manufacture of innovative tools and the development of complex behavior. According to Klein's theory, the rise in frequency of this mutation primed humans for some enabling trait, such as the ability to use conceptual language. Klein thought that prior to the occurrence of this mutation, humans were incapable of modern behaviors. Supporting his notion are examples among other species of a small number of genetic changes that have affected major adaptations, such as the five changes that are sufficient to turn the tiny ears of the Mexican wild grass teosinte into the huge cobs of corn that we buy in the supermarket today. Klein's hypothesis came under intense criticism almost as soon as he suggested it, most notably from the archaeologists Sally McBrearty and Allison Brooks, who showed that almost every trait that Klein considered to be a hallmark of distinctly modern human behavior was evident in the African and Near Eastern archaeological records tens of thousands of years before the Upper Paleolithic and later Stone Age transitions. But even if no single behavior was new, Klein had put his finger on something important. The intensification of evidence for modern human behavior after 50,000 years ago is undeniable, and raises the question of whether biological change contributed to it. One geneticist who came of age at this time of exuberance about the power of genetics to provide simple explanations for great mysteries was Svante Paabo, who arrived in Alan Wilson's laboratory just after the mitochondrial Eve discovery, and who would go on to invent much of the toolkit of the ancient DNA revolution and to sequence the Neanderthal genome. In 2002, Paabo and his colleagues discovered two mutations in the gene FOXP2 that seemed to be candidates for propelling the great changes that occurred after around 50,000 years ago. The previous year, medical geneticists had identified FOXP2 as a gene that, when mutated, produces an extraordinary syndrome whose sufferers have normal range cognitive capabilities but cannot use complex language, including most grammar. Paabo and his colleagues showed that the protein produced by the FOXP2 gene has remained almost identical during the more than 100 million years of evolution separating chimpanzees and mice. However, two changes to the protein occurred on just the human lineage since it branched out of the common ancestral population of humans and chimpanzees, showing that the gene had evolved much more rapidly on the human lineage. Later work by Paabo and his colleagues found that engineered mice with the human versions of FOXP2 are identical to regular mice in most respects, but squeak differently, consistent with the idea that these changes affect the formation of sounds. These two mutations at FOXP2 cannot have contributed to the changes after 50,000 years ago, since Neanderthals shared them. But Paabo and his colleagues later identified a third mutation that is found in almost all present-day humans, and that affects when and in what cells FOXP2 gets turned into protein. This change is absent in Neanderthals, and thus is a candidate for contributing to the evolution of modern humans after their separation from Neanderthals hundreds of thousands of years ago. Regardless of how important FOXP2 itself is in modern human biology, Paabo cites the search for the genetic basis for modern human behavior as a justification for sequencing the genomes of archaic humans. Between 2010 and 2013, when he led a series of studies that published whole genome sequences from archaic humans like Neanderthals, Paabo's papers highlighted an evolving list of about 100,000 places in the genome where nearly all present-day humans carry genetic changes that are absent in Neanderthals. There are surely biologically important changes hiding in the list, but we are still only at the very beginning of the process of determining what they are, reflecting a more general problem that we are like kindergartners in our ability to read the genome. While we have learned to decode the individual words, as we know how the sequence of DNA letters gets turned into proteins, we still can't parse the sentences. The sad truth is that it is possible to count on the fingers of two hands the examples like FOXP2 of mutations that increased in frequency in human ancestors under the pressure of natural selection, and whose functions we partly understand. In each of these cases, the insights only came from years of hand-to-hand combat with life's secrets by graduate students or postdoctoral scientists making engineered mice or fish, suggesting that it will take an evolutionary Manhattan Project to understand the function of each mutation that we have, and that Neanderthals do not. This Manhattan Project of human evolutionary biology is one to which we as a species should commit ourselves. But even when it is carried out, I expect that the findings will be so complicated, with so many individual genetic changes contributing to what makes humans distinctive, that few people will find the answer comprehensible. While the scientific question is profoundly important, I expect that no intellectually elegant and emotionally satisfying molecular explanation for behavioral modernity will ever be found. But even if studying just a few locations in the genome will not provide a satisfying explanation for how modern human behavior evolved, the great surprise of the genome revolution is the explanations it is starting to provide from another perspective, that of history. By comprehending the entire genome, by going beyond the tiny slice of the past sampled by our mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome, and embracing the story of our past, told by the multiplicity of our ancestors that is written in the record of our whole genome, we have already begun to sketch out a new picture of how we got to be the way we are. This explanation, based on migrations and population mixture, is the subject of this book. 100,000 Adams and Eves. When the journalist Roger Lewin in 1987 dubbed the common maternal ancestor of all people living today, mitochondrial Eve, he evoked a creation story, that of a woman who was the mother of us all, and whose descendants dispersed throughout the earth. The name captured the collective imagination, and is still used not only by the public, but also by many scientists, to refer to this common maternal ancestor. But the name has been more misleading than helpful. It has fostered the mistaken impression that all of our DNA comes from precisely two ancestors, and that to learn about our history, it would be sufficient to simply track the purely maternal line represented by mitochondrial DNA, and the purely paternal line represented by the Y chromosome. Inspired by this possibility, the National Geographic Society's Genographic Project, beginning in 2005, collected mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome data from close to 1 million people of diverse ethnic groups. But the project was outdated even before it began. It has been largely recreational and has produced few interesting scientific results. From the outset, it was clear that most of the information about the human past present in mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome data had already been mined, and that far richer stories were buried in the whole genome. The truth is that the genome contains the stories of many diverse ancestors, tens of thousands of independent genealogical lineages, not just the two whose stories can be traced with the Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA. To understand this, one needs to realize that beyond mitochondrial DNA, the genome is not one continuous sequence from a single ancestor, but is instead a mosaic. 46 of the mosaic tiles, as it were, are chromosomes, long stretches of DNA that are physically separated in the cell. A genome consists of 23 chromosomes, and because a person carries two genomes, one from each parent, the total number is 46. But the chromosomes themselves are mosaics of even smaller tiles. For example, the first third of a chromosome a woman passes down to her egg might come from her father, and the last two-thirds from her mother, the result of a splicing together of her father's and her mother's copies of that chromosome in her ovaries. Females create an average of about 45 new splices when producing eggs, while males create about 26 splices when producing sperm, for a total of about 71 new splices per generation. So it is that as we trace each generation back further into the past, a person's genome is derived from an ever-increasing number of spliced-together ancestral fragments. This means that our genomes hold within them a multitude of ancestors. Any person's genome is derived from 47 stretches of DNA corresponding to the chromosomes transmitted by mother and father, plus mitochondrial DNA. One generation back, a person's genome is derived from about 118, 47 plus 71, stretches of DNA transmitted by his or her parents. Two generations back, the number of ancestral stretches of DNA grows to around 189, 47 plus 71, plus another 71, transmitted by four grandparents. Look even further back in time, and the additional increase in ancestral stretches of DNA every generation is rapidly overtaken by the doubling of ancestors. 10 generations back, for example, the number of ancestral stretches of DNA is around 757, but the number of ancestors is 1,024, guaranteeing that each person has several hundred ancestors from whom he or she has received no DNA whatsoever. 20 generations in the past, the number of ancestors is almost 1,000 times greater than the number of ancestral stretches of DNA in a person's genome. So it is a certainty that each person has not inherited any DNA from the great majority of his or her actual ancestors. These calculations mean that a person's genealogy, as reconstructed from historical records, is not the same as his or her genetic inheritance. The Bible and the chronicles of royal families record who begat whom over dozens of generations. Yet even if the genealogies are accurate, Queen Elizabeth II of England almost certainly inherited no DNA from William of Normandy, who conquered England in 1066, and who is believed to be her ancestor 24 generations back in time. This does not mean that Queen Elizabeth II did not inherit DNA from ancestors that far back, just that it is expected that only about 1,751 of her 16,777,216 24th degree genealogical ancestors contributed any DNA to her. This is such a small fraction that the only way William could plausibly be her genetic ancestor is if he was her genealogical ancestor in thousands of different lineage paths, which seems unlikely, even considering the high level of inbreeding in the British royal family. Going back deeper in time, a person's genome gets scattered into more and more ancestral stretches of DNA spread over ever larger numbers of ancestors. Tracing back 50,000 years in the past, our genome is scattered into more than 100,000 ancestral stretches of DNA, greater than the number of people who lived in any population at that time. So we inherit DNA from nearly everyone in our ancestral population who had a substantial number of offspring at times that remote in the past. There is a limit, though, to the information that comparison of genome sequences provides about deep time. At each place in the genome, if we trace back our lineages far enough into the past, we reach a point where everyone descends from the same ancestor, beyond which it becomes impossible to obtain any information about deeper time from comparison of the DNA sequences of people living today. From this perspective, the common ancestor at each point in the genome is like a black hole in astrophysics, from which no information about deeper time can escape. For mitochondrial DNA, this black hole occurs around 160,000 years ago, the date of mitochondrial Eve. For the great majority of the rest of the genome, the black hole occurs between 5 million and 1 million years ago, and thus the rest of the genome can provide information about far deeper time than is accessible.